My address of 2 weeks ago on the subject, Is America Drifting Towards Sex Anarchy?, seems to have evoked considerable interest. I received many letters from near and far and telephone calls. Nearly all of them were in approval. They expressed appreciation for speaking out against the coarsening and vulgarization which were going on in American life, the lowering of standards, the overabsorption in sex in our literature and plays and movies and the press. Only one missive puzzled me. It was an open postcard, unsigned, of course, and it had just four words written on it in bold handwriting. How old are you? I have been unable to determine whether the writer meant to suggest that I was too young to know the facts of life or too old to appreciate them. As I suggested in my address 2 weeks ago, there is little difference of opinion among our people throughout the nation as to the facts in the situation. These facts have disturbed, they have alarmed our people. This morning I read, as you probably read, an alarming statement by the head of the FBI, Mr. J. Edgar Hoover, on the frightening increase in teenage and juvenile crime and delinquency in our country. The most serious problem, he said, confronting the American people today. And he called upon our people and those charged with law enforcement to stop coddling the juvenile criminal, for he is more dangerous than the adult criminal. Our people clearly do not want this situation of this frightening increase in crime, this increase in broken homes and divorces, and this general cheapening of life which is going on. They do not want this situation to continue. And what they fear, even more, to grow worse and deteriorate further if the trend is not checked or reversed. There is a basic wholesomeness in our people, a sound moral attitude on the part of the overwhelming majority of our people, and they are revolted, and they revolt against these increasing manifestations of gross indecencies all around them, which today are entering their homes through the media of the radio and the television. And they would like to put a stop to it, but they don't know how. And it must be acknowledged right at the outset that there is no simple or easy way of doing it. The moral reformation of an age, the improvement of taste, the raising of standard of conduct, are not the work of a day or the result of the enactment of a law. They come about, and they can come about, through the voluntary, concerted, and persistent, and enlightened effort of all the constructive agencies of a community. The home, and primarily the home, the school, the church, the many organizations of men and women, social and cultural in a community, the responsible leaders of public opinion and those who mold public opinion and set standards in a community, the conscientious owners and representatives of the media, of publishing and of radio and of television, broadcasting, of the theater, of the press, plus whatever government can properly do. A voluntary crusade for decency all along the line is possible and is long overdue. The moral house cleaning in our, among our people in this country is long overdue, not only to protect our children, but to protect ourselves against the corrosion of unbridled sensualism and spiritual debasement. But all this cannot come about as a result of any burning of the vanities. It is not the job for a 20th century Savonarola. Savonarola, who you may recall, violently sought to impose a new Puritanism on 15th century Florence. When he died at the stake, when his ashes were thrown into the Arno, his death, so historians tell us, was followed by scenes of profanity such as Florence had never witnessed before. True moral reform calls for far less violent and hysterical action, for far more care and intelligence, and above all, for far less reliance on coercion, legal force. Prohibition in our country not only failed to make America more sober, but brought in its train an epidemic of law-breaking and racketeering, the evils of which have persisted long after prohibition was repealed. Now, the one method of correcting moral abuses, whether it's in the press or the movies and books, which most readily commends itself to us is, of course, censorship, either through the enactment of laws, or when that is too tardy or is not feasible, through the organization of extra legal pressure groups who force the removal of books which they regard as unwholesome from newsstands and from bookshops, or who compel the owners of moving picture theaters not to show pictures which they regard as morally objectionable. These pressure groups are, as a rule, guided by the highest moral motives. They wish to protect people, especially young people, from the moral contamination of salacious books and pictures. They're not prudes. They're not narrow-minded Puritans on a rampage. Many of them are aroused parents, citizens, who regard these oversexed books and pictures as spiritual marijuana, dangerous to their children and to the youth of the nation. And one can fully sympathize with their indignation and their motives, even if one cannot fully approve of their methods. Now, the need for some kind of censorship is, of course, recognized by our federal government And in the enactments of many state and city ordinances, obscenity is subject to the censorship of the post office and the treasury departments. A local postmaster can make a decision as to accepting any particular book or paper for transmission through the mails. The collector of customs can permit or forbid a publication to enter this country. That's been long established in our legal procedure and in our traditions. The courts, however, have the right to review these decisions and to decide whether they are reasonable. And the courts have been rather lenient in their interpretation of what constitutes an obscene book. And as things stand today, it is the editors and the publishers themselves who really determine what they regard as being fit to print. Now, responsible editors and publishers who refuse to cater to the lowest taste of the reading public and to cash in on selling books which narrowly skirt the law against pornography. There are many such. There are others, of course, who are thoroughly unscrupulous, who specialize in the salacious book, not for art's sake, but for profit's sake, who see to it that there is a sufficient measure of the lewd and the erotic in each of their publications to ensure for it a large sale. Now, our courts and our law enforcing agencies are confronted in dealing with this subject with two very serious problems. What is the true definition of obscenity, which can be applied by courts as a sort of an unfailing yardstick? Where is the line to be drawn between pornography and realism? What is revolting and dangerous to one mind may not be so to another. What is shocking to one age may not be to another. History records frequent change in the standards of propriety. And what is harmless for the adult may not be so for the juvenile. And can all literature therefore be tailored to what teenagers can read with immunity? Now, these are difficult problems and cannot be answered offhand. There has been, and I doubt whether there can be, any clear-cut answer to these problems. Now, those publishers and writers, movie picture producers, etc., who seek excuses for cashing in on obscenity, will have no trouble in finding their excuse in one or another of these arguments. Decent writers, and publishers, and editors, producers, will not have to resort to them. Their sound moral sense and their social responsibility will guide them, and no legal yardstick is required to tell an intelligent, mature, and honest person what is clean and what is unclean. The second problem is this: what are really the bounds of censorship? Where does it end? How soon does the habit of censorship pass from the realm of morals to other fields, to the realm of ideas, of political opinion, of new censorship? A day or two ago, I picked up this item in a newspaper. Church protests Chicago TV ban on Luther film. The National Lutheran Council said yesterday that a Chicago television station violated freedom of expression when it canceled, under pressure, an agreement to show the film Martin Luther. The council, representing 8 Lutheran branches with 5 million members, said the cancellation followed pressure reputedly emanating from Roman Catholic sources. And it added, measures must be taken to prevent such censorship from becoming a precedent to justify similar freedom-throttling activities. The church-sponsored film depicting the life of the 16th century priest who sparked the Protestant revolt from Roman Catholicism has been shown in theaters in this country and abroad. The Chicago station has said it dropped the telecast because it did not want to cause any ill will. Now, there is the principle of censorship applied to a situation which does not at all involve a question of morals, but a question of, shall we say, theology. A few years ago, a motion picture, The Miracle, was ordered withdrawn by the Commissioner of Licenses for New York City and members of the Board of Regents on the ground that it was sacrilegious. Many other clergymen, both Protestants and Catholics, did not find that picture sacrilegious. Here is another criterion resorted to in the application of censorship. In Nazi Germany, the government outlawed all writings of which the Nazis did not approve and burnt books. It outlawed all the artwork of Jews, not on the basis of their immorality, but because Jews were the artists. In the Soviet Union, all art, literature, which in their mind is tainted by Western bourgeois ideas, but outlawed, a censorship applied to ideas. Not so long ago, the United States Information Agency canceled plans to send overseas a modern art exhibit which depicted scenes from American sports. And the agency canceled this exhibit because some patriotic groups complained that 4 artists whose works were represented in the show belonged to a Communist Front organization. So works of art are censored because the artist happens to entertain political or economic views which are not approved by certain groups or by the majority of the people. You may recall that a few years ago, under the pressure of McCarthyism, certain books were removed from American libraries abroad because some of the authors of these books, or some of the views expressed in these books, did not tally completely with the political views of a few members in Congress. Now, once the censorship habit gets well established, it has a way of overstepping its legitimate bounds and becomes a danger to the rights of free men in a democracy. And this is why the American people normally dislikes censorship. They don't want their thinking, their minds controlled by censors. The demand for censorship is, however, heard, sometimes very loud, when there has been a gross abuse of the patience of the American people and of their sense of elementary decency. And those who control the various media of public communication should bear this fact in mind. And they should not arouse and drive the American people to such extreme measures. For in emergency, the extreme measures will be resorted to. The United States Supreme Court has been rather consistently negative to a form of censorship of the moving picture, to film censorship. 3 years ago, by unanimous decision, the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional the banning of two films which had been outlawed, one in New York and one here in Ohio, outlawed on grounds of sexual immorality or incitement to crime. The ruling of the court was without a written opinion and did not spell out any absolute ban on film censorship. But Justice Jackson and Justice Black did hand down a separate but concurring opinion in which they declared that all state censorship is contrary to the First Amendment, our Constitution, which guarantees the freedom of speech and of the press. And they recognize the doctrine that expression by means of motion pictures is included within the free speech and free press guarantee of the First as well as of the 14th Amendment. And it's interesting to recall what they said at that time. Motion pictures are, of course, a different medium of expression than the public speech, the radio, the stage, the novel, or the magazine. But the First Amendment draws no distinction between the various methods of communicating ideas. On occasion, one may be more powerful or effective than another. The movie, like the public speech, radio, or television, is transitory, here, now, and gone in an instant. The novel, the short story, the poem, is in printed form, are permanently at hand to reenact the drama and to retell the story over and again. Which medium will give the most excitement and have the most enduring effect will vary with the theme and the actors. It is not for the censor to determine in any case. The First and the 14th Amendments say that Congress and the states shall make no law which abridges freedom of speech or of the press. And in order to sanction a system of censorship, I would have to say that no law does not mean what it says, that no law is qualified to mean some laws. I cannot take that step, declared Justice Jackson, with Justice Black concurring. In this nation, he said, every writer, actor, or producer, no matter what medium of expression he may use, should be free from the censor. Of course, that does not solve the problem with which we are dealing. Now, what legally constituted government authorities are reluctant to enforce, private groups of citizens ought not to attempt to do. That is, to arrogate to themselves the right to say what other citizens shall read or see. Such groups, of course, have the right to advise their own members what they should or should not read or view. They have the right to persuade others to do likewise. This is an effective way in a democracy to express approval or disapproval and should by all means be exercised if, after careful consideration, they believe that the case warrants it. But these private groups should not assume the role of moral vigilantes and take the law into their own hands and put pressure through various ways, mostly of economic intimidation, on news dealers or bookshops to remove the books of which they do not approve and to deny other citizens a free choice of what they wish to buy, or to enlist local police to threaten the bookseller. Private groups which have no legal status in the matter must not employ coercive measures to achieve even desirable ends. And on this subject, I quote with strong approval the words of a Catholic, a Jesuit professor of moral theology at Woodstock College, Maryland, Father John Courtney Murray. He declared, "Each minority group has the right to censor for its own members, if it so chooses, the contents of the various media of communication and to protect them by means of its own choosing from materials considered harmful according to its standards." And he also pointed out that in the United States, all religious groups are minority groups. No minority group has the right to demand that government should impose a general censorship on material judged to be harmful according to the special standards held within one group. Any minority group has the right to work toward the elevation of standards of public morality through the use of the methods of persuasion and pacific argument. No minority has the right to impose its own religious or moral views on other groups through the use of methods of force, coercion, or violence. And he quotes a statement of Jacques Leclerc of the Catholic University of Louvain, who stated, "No government has ever succeeded in finding a balanced policy of combating unhealthy sexual propaganda without injuring legitimate freedom or provoking other equally grave or worse disorders." And Father Murray states, "Censorship in the civil order must be a judicial process carried out under the statutes and according to the due processes of law." And that is sound doctrine. In my judgment, good friends, realizing the gravity and the urgency of the moral problem which exists, and in attempting to find ways of meeting the situation, in my judgment, there should be a minimum reliance on censorship in our efforts to raise the moral standards of our people, and a maximum reliance on self-censorship. We should concentrate on the individual and begin very early, in the home, primarily in the home, and in the school, and in the church, to inculcate sound moral standards and disciplines and criteria of judgment, to cultivate good taste in these various and through these various agencies, to cultivate good taste in books, in music, in the arts, so that the cheap and the vulgar and the tainted will not make any appeal to the youth in later life. to choose in their formative years carefully what is good for our children to see. Not to permit into our homes these horror books, these sadistic comic books filled with violence, which surround the mind of the child with a world of violence and cruelty and sadism. To give them the example of refinement and restraint and reverence for the basic decencies of life, in speech, in action, for the purity of family life. What is holy should not be treated as profane at any time. To give our children a code of behavior. It is not merely the children of the poor who crowd the ranks of the delinquent. Not at all. Frequently, children coming from our own homes and the better homes, so to speak. Begin with ourselves, each one. That's moral reformation. Accentuate the positive. Read and promote the good book. There are many first-rate books of great artistic merit being written, both in the fiction and in the non-fiction areas. Attend and promote the good play and the good movie. And there are many such admirable plays and movies. Withhold your own patronage from every book or play or movie which is unclean and unworthy, which wallows in the evil and in perversity and in lewdness. Be your own censor. Use your own freedom to discipline yourself and make your approval or your disapproval known to others, to the editors and to the playwright and to the producer. And those who arrange the programs for the radios and the television stations. Let the organized, the responsible organizations in a community praise and support the good and the fine in literature, in the theater, in the art, in music, in entertainment, and reject in their programs whatever is cheap and vulgar. I've been to functions of quite a number of highly respectable organizations, social and otherwise, who have put on plays frequently with the participation of their own members, men and women, who are vile and filthy beyond words. And so standards are set. I've known of organizations, fine organizations, dedicated to noble causes, who were invited to their program so-called humorists. And it was actually shameful to listen to the kind of humor, so-called, that was presented before respectable men and women. All these things are cumulative. They set fashions and tone and standards. They create a climate. Moral reformation must begin first with ourselves. There are many good people in this country who, as they became aware keenly of the problem, took hold of themselves and their households and the groups in which they have a voice. You'd be amazed what the cumulative effect of that would be in cleaning the atmosphere. The Ten Commandments, I have frequently said, are written in the second person singular.
thou shalt and thou shalt not.
There's no hope at all in correcting the situation if we mean to rely upon governmental agencies, upon somebody out there who will do this thing for us. Government reflects, ultimately, the tone and temper and the attitudes and standards of its citizens. And so less talk of censorship and more talk and action in terms of self-censorship.